Greetings, Internet, and welcome to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative professionals and entrepreneurs looking to grow by learning new things, getting inspired, and breaking down the barriers that prevent them from doing the work they were born to do. I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to episode 131, interview with Jessica Hebert. Jessica is currently working on a PhD in biology and is a graduate teaching assistant at Portland State University. Outside of her work in the lab and classroom, she is a singer-songwriter with the PDX Broadsides and a performer with PDX Yar. In this episode of Getting Work to Work, we discuss how art and science coexist in her life, how nerd culture has impacted her scientific journey, the joys of being a polymath, songwriting, swashbuckling, and the importance of being mentally flexible. Show notes and links for this episode can be found at gwtw.co/131. Getting Work to Work is brought to you by Chris Martin Studios, a media production company telling stories with heart, edge, and fearlessness through video, podcasts, and design for those who dare to build a better world. Keep in touch with Chris Martin Studios by signing up for the Curiosity Lab, my weekly email newsletter at gwtw.co/131. By doing so, you'll receive inspiration on Mondays and Fridays with ways to increase your creativity, curiosity, and wonder. All right, you ready for this interview with Jessica? Let's get into it. Jessica, thank you so much for being a guest on Getting Work to Work. Why don't you start by introducing yourself and share a little about what you do?
Hi, Getting Work to Work audience. I'm Jessica Hebert. I'm a PhD candidate in biology at Portland State University, and my work is at Oregon Health and Science University, and I study how placentas work and how sometimes they don't work. And in particular, my dissertation focuses on how boys are different than girls in terms of how they use their placentas. Fetal sex differences, who knew? Wow. I also work with HPV research, how you get cancer related to HPV in not just the cervix, but also in your tonsillar ring in the back of your throat and in other regions of your body. And I've been doing research for 15 years, but I defend my PhD in April, so I'm getting really close.
That's exciting.
When I'm not doing science, I am the quartermaster and president of Performing Portland Privateers, pdxyar.org. And I'm also a singer-songwriter with a Portland nerd folk pop band, the PDX Broadsides. We sing about Star Wars and Starbucks and science and things that don't start with S up and down the West Coast. And we just released our fourth studio album this summer. So scientist, songwriter, swashbuckler. Also, I apparently really do love the letter S.
That's awesome. So what got you interested in being a scientist?
I like solving problems. And I recognized that right away as a kid. I love Lego. And so getting to build new things and use my imagination and my brain to sort of create what I thought should work. And I was very lucky to work with a gifted and talented program growing up where we had access to like Lego motors and pulley systems and things. So right away I went, oh, these things are possible. I had no idea. Also, I took it as a bit of a challenge. As I got older, I said, I'm not very good at math, and then completed 2 years of calculus as these things go. But I took a year of AP chemistry, and my teacher, I said, I think I really want to go into biology and chemistry. I think they're really neat. And she said, I think you had better stick with musical theater. That seems to be where your talent lies. And I took that as a very, I'm not a very rebellious person, but I took it as a personal challenge. Yeah. And I graduated with, my undergrad was in biology and chemistry with a minor in Spanish. And I said, I really love this, but she was right. I did need sort of a creative outlet too. So I think that's where this sort of mash came together of my very random life of things that start with S.
Yeah. How do you bring science and art into coexistence? Is there ever like a conscious battle or struggle?
only interpersonally. when people try to tell me that I should only do one thing or I'm not focused in one area or another, but I think they actually feed each other. You need the creative stimulation as well as the intellectual stimulation. I like that music gets my brain moving in different ways, and that I can write a song about rocket science, which is a science that I'm not directly involved in, but I learn a lot about. And then that can help me in the lab if I'm trying to understand propulsion, like in a blood flow system. You learn little things along the way. So I think that they actually feed into each other very, very well.
Yeah. So what do people usually get wrong about science?
That it's hard. That's the first thing I hear when I say, I'm a scientist. And everyone immediately goes, oh, you must be really smart. And I am, but it's not, that's not the point. Like, science isn't for the most intelligent. Science is for the enthusiastic. Science is for the people who actually want to learn. And I love working with OMSI. I'm one of their science communication fellows. Cool. And I built, with help from their program, a model of a placenta. It's like a bunch of tubes and you squirt a baby in the face so you understand how preeclampsia works. It's really neat. Come to OMSI when they're doing these Meet a Scientist events at OMSI After Dark, or I think it's every other Saturday. And you'll see all sorts of scientists there with projects that they've built that you can actually interact with.
Oh, wow.
And the thing that we have the most trouble with the public, like, they love the displays and they want to touch and talk and everything. But at the end, sometimes there's an exit interview and they talk to people and say, so when you were talking to the scientists, and they go, whoa, whoa, wait a minute. Those were scientists? Like, they don't quite make the connection that these, because we're not all wearing lab coats. Yeah. And we're not all older bearded guys, I guess, that we're actually scientists. So showing people that, no, science is for you. And as long as you want to be here and you want to learn things, I want to talk to you. That's the hardest thing.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like one of your personal missions is really about making science accessible to people.
Yeah, it absolutely is. I hope to have science communication be a major part of my future career. So if you're looking for a postdoc in science communication, I am that postdoc for you. I really enjoy getting to talk to people who wouldn't normally have access about how this is absolutely for you. Like, what is it that you want to learn? How can we make it so that it's not... I hate when people say, oh, you're going to dumb down science. No, 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 no. I'm just going to find ways to make science a little bit more accessible, because sometimes science uses some high-handed words, which makes sense when you're inside the field. But yeah. I mean, I didn't really know anything about plant defense systems when I started my PhD. I knew absolutely zero. And now I've learned some, because there is a lab at Portland State, the Ballhorn Lab, that focuses on plant biology and plant defenses. Lima beans defend themselves.
Really?
Yep. And they have ways that they attract defenders so that they don't get attacked by other insects in the area, and they use a chemical extrusion to attract defenders for the plant. Huh. And I hope that if you're listening, like, you understood that, and not once did I have to say, like, they leak extracellular villus neck or whatever. Yeah. Like, in that little package, like, you get a snapshot of what their lab is about, and they do a much better job because they're all excellent science communicators too, which is why I've learned from them. That's part of my inspiration. When you see someone do something really well and you're like, I learned something. Wait, how did I learn something from them? And how can I get you interested in the fact that boys use their placentas differently than girls?
Yeah.
And that the baby makes the placenta. This is two fun facts that blow people's minds when they come to OMSI. One, that the placenta is a fetal organ, that the baby makes it, not the mom.
Wow.
And two, that the placenta is an organ, and it's the only temporary organ that the human body ever makes, and it's made by the baby. And
wow.
People walk away going, holy crap, I did not know that. I'm like, yeah, it's your first art project. Every single one of us has made one.
Wow.
And yeah, so that's like, how do you find ways to make, right?
Yeah,
I know.
My mind is blown.
I'm so excited that you're excited, because I'm excited that you are learning about a thing that has encompassed my entire life. Like, ask anyone who knows me, ask anyone at a cocktail party that I used to attend. I'm not invited to them anymore. Aww. Because, well, I'm like, look at these pictures of the placenta I took. And they're like, it was very nice to meet you. I'm just going to sidle off over here. But I'm very popular at baby showers. So that's important. And I'm also very passionate about getting people training so that they can do what I do, do what others do. And I'm always trying to get better too. One of those is ComSciCon Pacific Northwest, which is coming up in March. And it is for grad students and postdocs of any discipline, like English, history, biology, any of the STEM fields, like whatever it is that you're doing. If you want to communicate your work better to the public, we have it's a competitive program, and we offer a full weekend free workshop in Seattle. And I've been on the committee for that for 2 years. Yeah, I've been part of a couple of different science communication panels and have moderated and run them up and down the West Coast for different conventions. I just think it's important that people know that science is available for everyone and that you can learn how to communicate your science. Not that it has to be your job. Mm-hmm. And if you feel like you're bad at it, good news, there's a whole lot of us out there that you can hire if you feel like it's a thing that you actually want to get better at sharing your science. We got the tools, and we can show you how.
So apart from language, what are some of the things that can help scientists better communicate about their work? Because I think there's some correlation between scientists and creative professionals and artists on how to communicate to people that aren't in your daily pursuits about what you do.
Yeah, if you're talking about maybe the intersection of sci art, which is a pretty happening field right now, I've seen some really great collaborations between artists and scientists trying to make Jorge Cham of PhD Comics has done videos about different scientific concepts, including the brilliant Higgs boson comic. Oh, so good. Go look it up right now. And he did that in collaboration with a scientist who studies the Higgs boson, and they put out an entire book together. And that was kind of like, how do you explain science using art concepts? I've seen some very interesting collaborations where one person was a sculptor and another person was a hearing specialist, and they sculpted a 3D head and they put like hearing sensors all over it, and then took it into different environments to make 3D soundscapes. Ooh. To understand the movement of sound waves and things. They put it in public installations to get like mass chatter. It was very, very interesting. If you can imagine it can happen. Sci music is kind of where I live. And when I get invited to talk about like cross-disciplinary science, I'm like, well, I have a nerd pop band and I like bringing the science aspects in to songwriting. We have one song that actually Christian wrote, but I was so delighted about it. He said, why are you so excited? I said, because we can make the music move the same way that the physics does. Mm. So he wrote a song about the physics of a breakup called Delta You, Delta Me. So the motion is moving, and he had all of these physics concepts, and he said, it's a breakup song. And I said, oh yeah, it absolutely is. And so we sang it sort of as a duet, and then Holly added a beautiful third harmony to all the choruses. But what I wanted to do with the music was indicate points, like when we were talking about the history where the voices come closer together. Mm-hmm. And in one point he says, and now we're asymptotic. So the music line goes asymptotically, where it never touches. So we were able to use those concepts, and it's kind of a 5% joke when we do it, because it sometimes takes people a minute, but in general, our audiences are very smart, and we'll hear from them later and go, oh, I got it. Oh, that was very clever. When our fourth album came out this summer, Trust Issues, it was on there, and we ended up getting quite a bit of mail about, like, wow, you guys did that thing. Yeah, it was really neat. not every song is about science. I mean, we also sing about Shakespeare, and we were nominated for 2 awards this year, the Pegasus Awards for Excellence in Filk, for 2 songs. One is The Girl Who Couldn't Even, about a girl who just, oh my God, literally can't. And the other one was Nathan Fillion, Please Take Off Your Pants, which is a plea, a gentle plea to our very favorite captain of the Firefly universe about his derriere. So not everything is about science, but I mean, it creatively, it still fuels me. When I get excited about music, I'm also able to channel that energy into science and vice versa. Art is important. I have seen some very interesting collaborations. Those are a few examples of why science fits into pretty much every artistic sphere you can think of. Like, if you're interested in making a collaboration on your own, like, go to Twitter, use the hashtag SciArt, use a hashtag SciMusic, hashtag Sci, whatever it is that you do, and I promise you there is someone out there who wants to work with you.
That's awesome. So how has your love of nerd culture, sci-fi, and all things S impacted your scientific journey?
It's mostly for me a creative outlet. As a kid, I watched Star Trek with my dad. I was the right age for like the end of Next Gen to be still in first run. And then we watched Voyager together. Voyager in particular was an inspiration to me because Janeway, the first female captain of the Star Trek universe, I said, yeah, absolutely. If Janeway can commandeer a ship and get her start as a science officer, I can do great things as a scientist. So that was kind of where the seed got planted in my brain. I've always been very interested in science and technology, like I talked about at the top of the podcast. So on a daily basis, I would say that nerdery doesn't necessarily influence what I do in the lab, but it does make it easier to share because I am kind of in that nerd scene and I just want to be excited. Yeah. And nerds are excited about, and geeks are excited about the things that they love. And science is a thing that I love. So it makes it easier to share it. Even if I don't feel like I always have the proper and exact words for it, it's okay, as long as I want to share it and people are excited about it.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to not be excited about what you're talking about because your enthusiasm is coming across the airwaves in unbelievable proportion. And so I only imagine that person to person, you know, I would be like flying through the roof about now.
Good, excellent. And this is me pre-coffee. Yeah. I mean, you could put a cup of coffee in my hand. We can go for another hour.
So what do your fellow scientists think of your creative pursuits? Are you abnormal in that sense, or is creativity flowing through the scientific community?
I think it's very common, particularly in grad students. When I started the PhD program at Portland State, my cohort was about 15 people, and 5 of us were PhDs, and 10 of us were master's students. We're all sitting in the same room, and I'm like, we're doing introductions. I'm like, hi, I'm Jessica. I'm here to be a rotational PhD student, and I'm also sometimes a pirate. A couple of you recognize me, and I also have a nerd band. And they're like, wow, that's a lot. And the first question that the PIs would always give me is, so how much of it are you going to give up for grad school? Because grad school is going to take all your time. But the other students were like, oh, wow, that's a lot. I'm the lead singer in a metal band. I'm like, oh, okay. And there were people who like knit and sew. In grad school, you find a lot of people who say like, oh yeah, I don't have any hobbies, but they are running like every weekend, or they're training for marathons. Like, that's a hobby. Yeah. it's an intense hobby. I don't run from anything except zombies. But you find a way to have some sort of outlet, because you notice that the people who spend 80 to 100 hours in a week in the lab and they're not spending enough time on their families or on other pursuits, they're the ones who burn out. And I still want to be here in 50 years being this enthusiastic and telling you about how great science is. This is my long-term goal. So that creative outlet is what's going to keep me alive and fresh and doing this.
What a great lesson, though, because it's like it's I think it's the same thing in the creative professional pursuits, that those who just work eventually get to a point where they just can't sustain that work because they've got nothing else.
Right. Yeah, you can't burn yourself out. And I think it feeds really well into your creative pursuits. If you have something else that you love and you're passionate about, maybe you're an SCA person and you go do heavy fighting on weekends, or maybe you cross stitch or something, or you CrossFit. That, how do you know somebody who does CrossFit? Don't worry, give them 5 seconds, they'll tell you. Whatever it is that you have outside your main work, that's great. Maybe you have a family that you spend a lot of time with, like, but make sure that you're also still taking time for yourself.
Yeah.
That's important, to keep feeding that creative beast and that work beast, so that you can keep. I hope that most people, especially in the creative field, are doing it because they love it. So in particular, creatives need to take special care of themselves so that you don't burn out that spark.
Yeah. Good point. One of the things that I love in the just kind of doing some research on you and what you do is in your Twitter bio, you use the word polymath. And I think as we talk, it's a very appropriate label for you. I just read the Leonardo da Vinci bio by Walter Isaacson, and that's the person that pops into a lot of minds when you hear the word polymath. And when you Google polymath, that's usually the first result that comes up. But did you always want to have such a varied life of all of the different things so that you could live up to that word?
Yeah, well, I found out about that word this year. And I've heard polymath. I've also heard polymath. So in my brain, I always say polymath. But perhaps you will have heard it both ways.
That's right.
Thanks to psych at the end of this episode.
Yes. Are you a fellow psych fan?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, and it's streaming now on Amazon. So yeah, we've been rewatching the episodes. So good.
Did you like the movie?
I did. I wish that there would have been more actual psych action.
Yeah.
But it was fun. And I liked that anyone who was still in the little drummer boy challenge had that ruined for them in the first 10 seconds of the movie, because sometimes I'm a curmudgeon.
Yeah.
I always wanted to have a varied life. Yeah, I don't think that I ever wanted to be put in one little box. Why? When there's so much out there to explore and try and like learn about. So I've always wanted that. The word polymath I learned at SciComm camp in LA this year, where there were a whole bunch of people there. Like, this was a gathering of people who want to be or are already science communicators and want to share what they have learned. So we had people from television. We had one of the head writers from Bill Nye Saves the World. And we had people who do like long-term like theater interaction with scientists, like how do you better express yourselves, people who lead major TV shows about science, just kind of the typical communicator. And then we also had people who did policy careers that I thought I'd heard everything in SciComm at this point, and I hadn't. Like, oh yeah, I have a company that put together the statistics on fire safety. And then we tell people about them, like, oh, I didn't realize that that was a thing. Of course it's a thing. So we were sitting around talking about our lives, and I realized everyone in the room had some other passions, and we were all just like weird kids, very excited about the intersection of science and a whole lot of other things. And the word polymath came up, and I was like, we're all polymaths. You guys, which, you know, if you follow the word polymath with you guys, takes kind of the strength out of it right away. But we were very excited about this word that encompassed kind of who we all were and the power that we felt in identifying other people who were like us. So a whole bunch of us put it in our Twitter bio at the same time that weekend. And so if you look through like hashtag SciComm, you'll find a bunch of people in their Twitter bio, and we all identify as polemoths because we are. A polemoth is a person, you used to maybe call them a Renaissance man, but I feel like that's a term for someone who has made like the pinnacle of their field. And I feel like polemoths are just interested in the intersection of things and how do we get excited about knowledge and share that with other people. Like that's what a good polemoth is.
Yeah. Sign me up.
Yeah. I think you're already more than halfway there. If you want to be a polemoth, like you can be a polemoth. Yeah. There's no, I'm not gatekeeping this club.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny too, because like, as I kind of reflected on it, I'm like, well, it's kind of like the argument in layman's terms of generalist versus specialist. It's like, there's like this push oftentimes to specialize, be good at one thing. You can't be good at many things. And it's just like, but I like so many other things.
Yeah, I think there's an XKCD comic that illustrates what happens when you go to grad school. When you become a specialist versus a generalist, like they show you a big circle of knowledge, and then you get the pie slice of what you learn in undergrad, and then what you learn as a grad student, and what you learn as a postdoc. And by the end of it, you're like, this is a giant circle, and you've moved the boundary of knowledge out like one pinprick. They're like, so that's what you've done. Mm-hmm. Good job. Like, but it's still moving the pinprick. So specialists are still expanding the boundaries, and that is important too. It's very easy to get wrapped up in the pinprick and say everything that has ever mattered is fetal sex differences in the placenta. And that's not true. Like there's so many things that else that matter. How do we shed light on all of them? So as long as you still maintain a big picture view while working on that pinprick, you'll be okay. The danger is just getting wrapped up in it.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about PDXR. What is it and how did you get involved with the group?
Oh, man. Oh, the pirates. So I started as a performing pirate the summer of 2006. And I started as a performing pirate because my boyfriend at the time, who's now my husband, was performing with a bunch of folks doing the Canterbury Tales for different schools. And they said, oh, yeah, by the way, we also do this pirate thing. Would you be interested? And he goes, yeah, that sounds cool. Also, my girlfriend did a bunch of work with the SCA and other stuff. That might be something she's interested in. And I had a real penchant for singing sea shanties, and they picked up on that pretty fast. So I joined one pirate group, and we were with them for a couple of years. We were starting to think, like, maybe it's time for something different. I've been hanging out with another group of people who did piratical gaming, and they were like, we'd like to kind of get into performance. And we said, we're the performers you're looking for. Let's help you build a performance group. So that was PDXR, and that was about 10 years ago now that it became a performance group. So I've been a performing pirate for it'll be 12 years this summer. And I love the sea shanties. Ask me about the sea shanties between 1650 and 1730, the golden age of piracy, and I can tell you a lot of things. We also do like submariner shanties from into the 1900s, the whaling songs of the 1800s. That's a lot of fun. We do sword fighting, fire dancing, general piratical color. We have a full cannon and black powder line, so we bring out the blunderbusses and the pistols, and we can tell you, we've done presentations at OMSI about the science of gunpowder. So there again, there's an intersection. We've done lots of presentations for OMSI about the science of sail, why Bernoulli's principle is important when you're building a boat, why sea shanties are actually a very important part of the sailing tradition. It was so they were work songs, and to keep rhythm. Rhythm is a scientific concept. the science of gunpowder. So there's a lot of intersections happening here with piracy, and that's one connection that we've been able to make with the educational communities. All right, so sometimes you see us in a bar and we're just yelling at people because that's what we're paid to do, but we're also, we're historical fictioneers. We're here to entertain and edutain.
I like the fictioneer. That's cool.
I got inspired by Walt Disney Company. They call themselves the Imagineers. Yeah. And I'm like, we're historical fictioneers.
Yeah.
So
that's really cool.
Thanks.
Yeah. So all of this that you're talking about today reminds me of the importance of, I guess, being mentally flexible and not putting your identity solely in one category. I guess, how do you keep your identity fluid each day between all of these different things?
That can be a struggle, especially when we think about social identity. Like, how do you represent yourself on social media? And the best advice I can give is you have to sort of just be yourself. I follow a bunch of Twitter accounts that are science communicators and scientists where all they talk about is their one thing. And I love them, but they sort of become like aggregators for that one subject. I don't do that. Like, I'll talk about science and I talk about music. And I also, like, I can't help it. You're going to learn about me personally because, like you said, I'm enthusiastic. And that is sort of just going to leech into, like, let me tell you about who I am.
Yeah.
I feel like I get the most connection with people on Twitter and Facebook and other social media who are just genuine human beings. So I want to be as genuine with people who want to talk to me about any of those things as I can too, and foster that connection. If you're talking about identity, for me personally, I don't think about it very much. I just sort of do the best I can. There isn't time for me to worry about it.
That's good.
With massive work weeks, I just, and creative loads, you just got to get the work done and you find the things that, like, I sort of follow what it is that I want to do that day. And I make a lot of lists and say, all right, these are the things I have to get done. But it's okay to sort of sample the order a little bit and I can follow. But yeah, I feel like social media, like the outward facing thing, like how is it that the public is going to necessarily perceive my very weird life? Are they going to think that I'm not serious enough about science, or that I'm not really a professional musician because I have a day gig that I clearly enjoy?
Mm-hmm.
That can be difficult, but all I can do is just do the best work I can and show that I love what I do. I genuinely do, and hope that other people will come along for the ride.
That's awesome. So just two more questions for you.
Sure.
If you could collaborate with any scientist alive or dead, who would it be?
I have commissioned several art pieces of Rosalind Franklin, who is the true discoverer of the structure of DNA. My favorite science joke is, what did Watson and Crick discover? Rosalind Franklin's notes. My piano, which is actually sitting behind me. Oh, you can almost see it.
I see the keys.
In the video. Yeah, that is that. My piano's name is Rosalind Franklin.
Oh, cool.
And we were able to purchase Rosalind Franklin thanks to the PDX Broadsides had a Kickstarter this spring for a fourth album. And we funded in 16 hours.
Oh, wow.
We had a set of stretch goals, and we blew through the stretch goals in like a week. And we went, oh, no, we need to come up with more stretch goals. So at like 250%, our stretch goal was Jessica gets a new piano, because I started adding piano in the last year. And they funded it while we were doing an on-the-air concert, and I cried. And they said, what are you going to name it? And I blurted out, Rosalind Franklin. And I was like, no, not really. I'll find another name. And they were like, the fans were adamant. They're like, no, you name it Rosalind Franklin now. So her name is Rosalind Franklin. I'm going to get a little brass plaque made for her that says Rosalind Franklin. So I guess that's my answer. She was the grandmama of X-ray crystallography, and I feel like I would learn a lot from her about some of the structures of the interesting protein dynamics that we're finding in the placenta. So scientifically, like academically, there were a lot of things that we can collaborate on. I wonder what she would think about immune cascades happening, if she would have thoughts or like be able to identify new factors. My greatest regret is when I talk to people about her and they get excited, they're like, oh, where can we find more of her research? And I said, well, she died very young. She died at 37 from ovarian cancer. She would have won the Nobel on her own for her work, but you can't win a Nobel posthumously. So she wasn't eligible. But her work laid the foundation for protein structure work, for the structure of DNA, like anything that we know about the structure of macromolecules. That's Rosalind's work. So I think she'd be, I'm a super fan. So I think she'd be really neat to work with. I'm afraid that I would be super nervous to work with her, but in alive, I really love the work of Graham Burton. He's at University of Cambridge, and he studies the way that the placenta changes as impacted by fetal sex. He's been doing it for a long time, how the shape of the placenta changes. And he has two really amazing collections of placentas at University of Cambridge, the Boyd Collection and the Dixon Collection. And they were all like harvested and sampled and sliced out in the 60s and 70s. And they are like, they are the perfect images to understand how the baby and the placenta interact. He's kind of genius. And I would love the opportunity to get to work with him for an extended period someday. So those are my two answers, I guess.
Very cool. So final question for you, what is one book that has impacted you the most in your pursuit of your creative and scientific life?
Two is a good number again. I'll go with two. One is Daring Greatly by Brené Brown. She opens with the man in the arena quote from Teddy Roosevelt. It's the man in the arena who sweats, who toils, who labors. Like, he's the one who gets our admiration. It's all about vulnerability and how, by putting ourselves out there, that's how we conquer fear and that's how we make the most impact with people. So that's been very important to my science communication life and also to my performing life. The other book is How to Write a Lot by Paul Sylvia. And he pulls no punches. The first paragraph is put your inner Muppet away, like just sit down, shut up and write. And we're like, okay. It was the first book that we were assigned in the graduate program at Portland State. And I got through it and it's like, don't make excuses. Make time to write every day. Like, you don't need a special table. You don't need a special chair. What you need is time and focus. Here are some ways you can get that. Form a group and meet up with them, not only for accountability, but also so that you have a built-in group of editors. So that's been very important to me scientifically, to get things written, to get things done on deadline, to have a group of people to complain to when things go wrong, and like they need it too. And then creatively, my band provides that sort of feedback for me. And it's good when we write things individually and then bring them together to work on them, to sort of finesse the concepts. But when it comes to songwriting, sometimes it comes out in one chunk and sometimes it comes out in little pieces. And there's been times when I'll have a little piece and I go, I know that this is really important. I need some help with this. And I can take it to my band, my writing group, and say, what you got? What do you hear in this? And vice versa. And that's how you collaborate and build better things. So How to Write a Lot by Paul Sylvia is available on Amazon, and so is Daring Greatly by Brené Brown, but they're both definitely worth your time if you're thinking about the intersection of art and science, or just you want to be more vulnerable in your work, or you want to actually make some work and get rid of excuses.
Awesome. Well, Jessica, thank you so much for your time today. I have to say that you are just so encouraging and enthusiastic with how you talk about your work and your life. And just thank you for being willing to share and be excited.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. I really enjoy getting to talk to different folks about why all of this is really neat. If you're interested in learning more, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at @Dame_DNA, like the molecule. Or if you look for #TeamPlacenta, I post on that fairly frequently about science. My band is at PDX Broadsides. And we're also pdxbroadsides.com. You'll also find us on Spotify, iTunes, Tidal, and anywhere fine music is sold on the internet. And the Pirates, the Privateers of Portland, the Swashbucklers of Stumptown, the Corsairs of the I-5 Corridor, PDX Yar, can be found on Facebook and at pdxyar.org.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much. Bye, guys.
That does it for this episode of Getting Work to Work. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to this podcast. It means so much to me that you do. Would you be willing to share Getting Work to Work with your friends, other creative professionals, and entrepreneurs? You can send them to gwtw.co or have them search for Getting Work to Work on most podcast platforms. Got a few moments to let me know what you think of the show? Head to Getting Work to Work on iTunes, click ratings and reviews, and either click the number of stars to rate the show or write a review. Thank you so much. Would you like to be a guest on a future episode of Getting Work to Work or know someone who should be on the show? Maybe you need some advice or just want someone to say hi to. Drop me a line by sending me an email. I'm chris@chrismartinstudios.com. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.